Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Residents of the Florida Panhandle bring their frustrations to lawmakers in Tallahassee.
It's just been shocking how little has happened. That we were off the radar within 2 or 3 days, and we have not come back.
Also tonight, it's been a long-term goal, but Florida lawmakers appear closer now than they've ever been to doing away with the state's local community redevelopment agencies.
So lawmakers have been trying to kind of curb their powers for a while.
We'll also get the latest on efforts by state lawmakers to rein in what they consider other forms of regulatory overreach by the state, city, and county governments. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to the midpoint of week number 7 in Florida's 2019 lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. Residents of Panama City and other areas of the Florida Panhandle that were walloped by Hurricane Michael came to legislators' doorsteps to make some noise today. Ryan Daly reports half a year after the storm, the area is desperate for funding to help schools, debris removal, and housing.
850!
Let's get our signs up. Let's show everybody here who we are. That's right.
850!
For many who took the trip down together by bus, the day started at 4:30 a.m. Carrie Baker, a recently retired educator who taught at Gulf Coast State College, made the trip as one of the many advocating for Panhandle schools.
Education is crucial. Our children are suffering in our schools. We have a lot of problems after Michael, but one of the most significant is our children.
Baker says she's concerned about students' ability to thrive in an educational environment that's still struggling to find stability, reeling from loss of students and teachers. She says rebuilding the area and solving a housing crisis caused by the storm are dominoes that need to fall before schools can heal.
We've lost so many students until it impacts the ability of the school to be schools to be funded, but then you have to think about the fact that unless we can rebuild and regroup, we can't get those students back.
India Hansen attends Bay High School in Panama City. She's felt the aftermath of the storm firsthand.
A lot of my friends left, and it's really hard. One of them was my best friend on the tennis team, and he had to move to Jacksonville with his family.
And aside from so many of her peers having to leave, Hansen and her classmates' school life still hasn't returned to normal.
It's really painful to see our school still in shambles. We're in portables at Bay High.
Leela Shuffler is relatively new to Panama City, having moved in not long before the storm hit. But the response following Hurricane Michael is unlike any she's seen in the state, and not for a good reason.
I think more than anything, as a longtime Floridian, formerly of Tallahassee and now of Panama City, that it's just been shocking how little has happened.
Shuffler wishes the public's response could resemble that of other recent disasters, even citing France's historic Notre Dame Cathedral going up in flames earlier this week.
They raised just recently $1 billion for Notre Dame just a couple, 3 days ago, which is wonderful, but my goodness, we've had $2 billion, I think, total. For our whole Panhandle area.
That disparity in attention paid to the Panhandle relative to more densely populated areas is not lost on State Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Patronis.
We're a part of the state where, they scratch their heads. Why is there not this outcry? Why is there not this just demand to fill it? And you look at other disasters around the state or disasters around the nation with the type of support a Hurricane Harvey received or Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy received, and the dollars and cents don't make up.
Petronas says the Panama City residents who traveled to Tallahassee had the right idea to show up at the Capitol.
What the difference is you got massive population centers that were hit, and those big population centers are able to advocate in ways to be able to move the needle. But this is what you're doing today. You're moving the needle.
And Petronas, whose hometown is Panama City, says it all comes down to funding.
That's my home. And you just want the recovery to take place. And look, in every single thing, every single problem takes money.
We have never had this much time pass post-storm and not had a disaster supplemental passed.
That's Panama City Republican Representative Jay Trumbull, who also spoke at the rally to call out Congress for what he says is a lack of action.
That's the problem we're in. That's what we are seeing today, is that the federal government is playing politics with people, with our people, and that is not right.
Though Trumbull told the crowd he does think there are better days ahead.
And I believe absolutely help is on the way as it relates to the state of Florida. For workforce housing, as an example, we have $126 million set aside for Hurricane Michael affected areas to be funded. We've got a $50 million grant program.
But until funding starts coming in and rebuilding ramps up, Carrie Baker says many will continue to feel invisible.
I thought it was just essential that our voices be heard. We're in the panhandle of Florida and feel like we've been forgotten.
I'm Ryan Daly.
On Capitol Report, Sean Mulcahy joins us. And a little bit later on in the program, we're going to be looking at what are called some preemption efforts by the Florida legislature to kind of rein in what many members consider regulatory overreach by cities and counties. But you were following one specific area today, something called community redevelopment agencies, which local governments make use of. What was the deal on that debate?
That's correct, Tom. So community redevelopment agencies exist to eliminate blight in communities. That's their main goal. And they've come under fire recently for a lot of reasons. There have been some bad actors, specifically, the Tallahassee Community Redevelopment Agency has been not implicated, but has been sort of sidelined to the FBI investigation in City Hall. So lawmakers have been trying to kind of curb their powers for a while. And so a bill that has just moved through the Florida House, it's been approved today on this House floor, adds in a bunch of new requirements for CRAs. These include things like new auditing requirements. They have to, adhere to much stricter budgets and be much more transparent on their websites. Their board members have to undergo ethics training. And it actually begins to phase out CRAs. So the way it works currently is CRAs are established for a set time period to work in a certain area called a community redevelopment area, and they exist only to improve that area. But what's happened recently is the board has been voting to renew these different CRAs. A lot of lawmakers aren't happy with that, so this bill would actually phase them out. If they had existing bonds, they could vote to renew, but that would require a two-third vote by the Community Redevelopment Board. And to establish any new CRA in the state, the county in which it exists would have to vote via a referendum, and that would need two-thirds vote to pass.
All right, but that still would allow localities to use something called special taxing districts, which are a lot more restrictive. It would just do away with the community redevelopment agencies over time then.
Yes, of course. And it's important to note here, there's been a lot of misconceptions about community redevelopment agencies, but they don't actually use any taxpayer money. They're funded by what's called tax increment funding. So in other words, the increase in property value that comes from the redevelopment, that extra is what is used to fund them. It's not any actual taxes.
But in any event, it would seem that if not having its days numbered, at least community redevelopment agencies in the Florida legislature are in deep trouble right now and might have their plugs pulled before the end of session. But you'll be keeping an eye on that, I'm sure, Sean Mulcahy.
Of course, I'll keep watching.
Okay, and thanks for joining us on Capitol Report.
Thank you.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida cities and counties are fuming as state lawmakers continue their assault on local autonomy.
The state of Florida doesn't like it when the federal government mandates something for them. So, you know, why should it be wise for the state of Florida to mandate something for the local level, for the local jurisdictions?
Lawmakers are looking at letting businesses absorb the cost of paying sales tax in an effort to help them compete.
The small business owner would then be able to absorb that sales tax to be able to compete with that larger retailer or that out-of-state retailer.
And a Florida researcher uncovers dramatic new evidence of what happened the day the dinosaurs died.
You'll have materials flying all over the world from that impact site.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Florida's local governments and their backers are urging state legislators to back off their relentless drive to preempt city and county regulatory authority. Gabrielle Bolden has more.
Preemption gives the state legislature the ability to limit or override local government rules. The policy has caused both lawmakers and local governments to bump heads for years in turf battles. American Heart Association Florida Director Mark Landreth says the state is being hypocritical.
The state of Florida doesn't like it when the federal government mandates something for them. So, you know, why should it be wise for the state of Florida to mandate something for the local level, for the local jurisdictions?
Organizations met at the Capitol Wednesday to speak against the policy. The Florida Immigrant Coalition's Ida Escamani calls preemption a strategic way to block the community's opinions.
We've seen this onslaught of bills this session designed to limit the voters' voice, centralize power here in Tallahassee, adopt a one-size-fits-all mentality in Florida, and it's supported always by the same special interests who are looking out for their bottom line and their profit margins.
Escamani's sister is State Representative Anna Escamani. The Orlando Democrat says with 412 municipalities in 67 different counties in the state, preemption isn't in the best interest of the public.
It's a lot easier to operate with one flat policy versus every local municipality having their own ordinance. So I understand the incentive, but it also oftentimes strips away the characteristics of our communities and preempts local control, local home rule, and their ability to make these decisions.
However, Representative Anthony Sabatini says sometimes local governments abuse their power.
Some political subdivisions, some cities and counties choose to continue to create ordinances in that area. They're essentially rogue. They decide to do whatever it is they want to do.
Florida lawmakers are considering preemption measures on plastic straws, sunscreen, Airbnbs, and more. I'm Gabrielle Bolden.
Here's another instance of state lawmakers attempting to limit the role of Florida cities and counties when it comes to autonomous policymaking. A pair of bills inches closer to the Florida House and Senate chambers, Senate Bill 168 and House Bill 527, would prohibit local governments from sanctuary policies. Kevin Del Orbe reports on the bipartisan debate lawmakers are having leading up to the bill's vote.
Currently, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, encourages state and local law enforcement to notify them when they have an illegal immigrant in their custody. Sanctuary cities around the country claim they won't report these cases to ICE agents. Some Florida lawmakers say that's a no-go. A pair of bills have caused a bipartisan divide, with many Senate and House Democrats saying the measures are xenophobic.
Suspicion isn't a fact, but it does fan the flames of bigotry, bias, and intolerance.
Congressman Darren Soto joins Senate Minority Leader Audrey Gibson as she addresses Democratic representatives and senators in a press conference moments before the bill's last vote in a Senate committee.
Senate Bill 168 ignores all of the positive reasons people come and want to be with all of us. The bill sends a message of division, and it does not recognize the diverse state that we are in Florida. And it just seems that they want to lock people up because they look different, talk differently, or seem different, and fan fear.
Republicans who back the bills say this legislation is on the basis of public safety and rule of law. In a Republican press conference, Bill's sponsor in the House, Representative Cord Byrd, talks about crimes committed by undocumented immigrants.
We've had several Floridians, including a 13-year-old girl in Pasco County who was killed by an illegal immigrant. And every one of these deaths is a preventable death if we just follow the rule of law.
Byrd stresses these bills have nothing to do with race.
And this is not anti-immigrant. This is about not putting either legal or illegal immigrants over American citizens.
A 2017 study conducted by Michael Light of the University of Wisconsin at Madison and Ty Miller of Purdue University found the increase of undocumented immigration does not cause more crime. The researchers looked at data spanning from 1990 to 2014 and compared those numbers to an index of violent crimes kept by the FBI. The report found no relationship between an increase in undocumented immigration and violent crime. I'm Kevin DeLorbe.
A measure is moving through the Florida legislature that lawmakers hope will help small businesses better compete. Regan McCarthy reports the bill would let companies absorb the sales tax in a transaction.
Think about when you go to the movie theater. You know that when you go to the movie theater, it's a $15 admittance. You're paying tax with them, but it's not $11 and some change, and then the tax. So you just know what you're paying for. And it's up to the retailer then to pay the tax.
Tampa Democratic Representative Susan Valdez says that's an example of a company absorbing the cost of sales tax. She has a bill that repeals a state provision preventing that.
This bill is about creating a consumer sales tax benefit by removing the prohibition Florida currently has on a business absorbing the sales tax on a transaction and paying it for the client or the customer.
And Boca Raton Republican Representative Mike Caruso says there are cases where the practice just makes sense. He calls the measure the ballpark bill.
You're sitting there watching a baseball game and a guy comes around selling peanuts and you say how much, he's not going to say $9.43 plus tax. You know, it's $10. And so... I think it allows for the ease of a transaction in a situation that doesn't allow for a cash register or somebody trying to figure out how much the tax is. So we're not passing $10.60 down the aisle and making change. We're just sending a $10 bill. And then the Marlins would then, I say the Marlins because that's from back home. The Marlins would then submit the 57 cents of sales tax they collected on that $10 total transaction.
Ocala Republican Senator Dennis Baxley has a similar bill. He thinks the measure would help give brick and mortar stores a more level playing field when it comes to competing with online companies.
This, I believe, will have an impact of helping us collect more due taxes. I think it will encourage retailers to figure out how to more effectively compete with those folks that are not turning in their taxes. This is sales tax only, and it makes clear that you are paying their sales tax.
And Tim Nungesser with the National Federation of Independent Businesses says it could open up a few other opportunities for businesses to be competitive.
From our perspective, a small business owner will be able to absorb a tax that they can't absorb under current law. So from our perspective, it would be allowing that small business owner to be a little bit more competitive. In a lot of cases, you have a small business owner will enter into a contract with a manufacturer, and under that contract, they have to charge a set MSRP. So in this case, the small business owner would then be able to absorb that sales tax to be able to compete with that larger retailer or that out-of-state retailer.
Orlando Democratic Representative Anna Escamani says she likes the idea of giving businesses more ways to set themselves apart in the marketplace.
And I could also see, you know, a business in a county perhaps wanting to compete with other counties, and so trying to swallow some of the costs to be competitive with regional areas around them who might have a different sales tax rate.
Right now, 30 other states allow businesses to absorb sales tax. Under the bill, retailers must provide a receipt that shows the amount of sales tax that was due and will be paid by the business. I'm Regan McCarthy.
With the Passover Easter break coming up fast, Gina Jordan says lawmakers have a fairly busy schedule over the next 24 hours.
Here's some of what's happening in the Florida legislature. Tomorrow marks the 45th day of the 60-day regular session. In the House, a bill providing death benefits for survivors of first responders and military members gets a committee hearing. The proposal would carry out a constitutional amendment passed by voters in November. A new cost recovery charge may be approved by which investor-owned electric utilities may recover their costs to implement a 30-year storm protection plan. The Department of Financial Services may soon oversee a 24-member Florida blockchain task force. Blockchain is an open, distributed ledger technology that permanently records transactions between two parties without needing third-party authentication. The task force would develop a master plan for fostering the expansion of the blockchain industry in the state. It would recommend ways to help make the state a leader in the technology. In the Senate, the Appropriations Committee does most of the work tomorrow. An education bill would establish the Family Empowerment Scholarship Program for grades K through 12. School districts would have to provide statewide assessments and related materials to certain private schools when requested. A bill revises the criteria used by the Department of Environmental Protection to determine annual funding priorities for beach erosion control projects and inlet management projects. And pilot programs may be authorized for the state to explore the implementation of innovative transportation technologies like self-driving cars. That's some of what's happening tomorrow at the Capitol. I'm Gina Jordan.
A plan for expanding and building three toll roads on the western side of Florida was put on hold by its sponsor today as Democrats were set to push for more specifics on the environmental and land use impacts. Senator Tom Lee, the Republican who's carrying the proposal, said he continues to massage the controversial measure. The plan, a priority of Senate President Bill Galvano, is now expected to be taken up next Tuesday by the full Senate. Lee said he's working with Democrats and environmentalists on some additional changes, but otherwise believes the proposal will eventually sail out of here, in his words, and become a conference issue with the House as budget talks get underway next week. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, there are those who might consider at least a few of the human creatures found in and around the Florida Capitol kind of scary, but we can only imagine the sheer terror that a person would experience if they ever came face to face with the kinds of creatures that inhabited this planet during the late Cretaceous period. After a Palm Beach paleontologist found new evidence in North Dakota of the asteroid strike that caused the extinction of dinosaurs 66 million years ago, the findings had to be verified. Florida International University researcher Florentin Maras studied the soil samples from the fossils paleontologist Robert DePalmer uncovered to verify their accuracy. Maras spoke with WLRN's Luis Hernandez about the findings.
Give us a sense of just how massive a strike that asteroid was.
Just visualize a bolide 10 kilometers across or 6 miles across hitting the Earth. Just visualize this hitting Dade County, for instance. What would you see? This would be incredible. That means you'd have materials flying all over the world from that impact site, and the rocks at that impact site will be all molten up, flying as a little splash of liquid rocks, and they fall back to the Earth as what we call tektites.
What did DePalma find in North Dakota that helps us to understand what really happened?
The Hell Creek Formation has been known for quite a while.
This is a very famous place to find dinosaurs.
Yeah, exactly. But nobody has ever found a mix of terrestrial and marine organisms. And this is the first time that he found it.
The asteroid strike was in the Yucatan.
Oh, yeah.
Of Mexico. You've been down there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, you can, I guess I can understand when I'm looking at a map, you know, okay, that makes sense. This is where it, the way it's shaped, this is where it hit. But what do you see when you're there? What do you find that's there that tells you what happened?
What you see is that there is a break between the sediment below and the sediment above. And at that break, you'll see sets of rocks, or what we call sediments, that look very different from the one below and the one above. And then when you look very close, then you'll see there are some kind of structures, there are all kinds of deposits that really don't belong there. So that's what you'll see.
And there's basically, when you look at the layers over the millions of years, there is that one layer that tells us this is where there was a stop of life. Everything ended here because there was something cataclysmic happened.
Exactly, yeah.
Why are you so fascinated by asteroid strikes, life-ending cataclysms, and so forth?
That means this is something exceptional, because when we look at the geologic record, there have always been species that come in and out. They become extinct. So this is something that we are familiar with. But for a long, long time, geologists, paleontologists could not answer the question why at that particular level we had a sudden extinction of not just the dinosaurs, but hundreds, thousands of species all over the world. And there was also always some kind of a break. So it was a big puzzle until, of course, the Alvarezes find some deposits in Italy with the iridium, and then they proposed the impact hypothesis, which slowly became really very well known and accepted. The fascination about it is so exceptional to find the evidence that could have really wiped out all those species all of a sudden.
So this evidence that De Palma found, is this the definitive piece of evidence we need? Can we now say, this is it, this is what happened?
Oh yeah, that means that's one of the definitive evidence, because we have had definitive evidence almost everywhere. But what does particular discovery shows us is the magnitude of those waves that came from the Gulf of Mexico, penetrating all the way inside, more than 1,500 kilometers from the impact site.
That was FIU researcher Florentin Mara speaking with WLRN's Luis Hernandez. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Thanks also to Gabrielle Bolden and Luis Hernandez. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again every weeknight throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care, on the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes, offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag.